Legacy Foundation is working with the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation on a project here in Lake County that which is being called On the Table. And to talk about it, we have the chief executive of the Legacy Foundation, Carolyn Saxon, with us. Carolyn, take some time. Tell us a little bit about what On the Table is and when it's going to debut here in Lake County.
Okay. On the Table was started by the Chicago Community Trust 4 years ago. And the idea was to gather information from people in small settings, usually over a meal, maybe breakfast, lunch, dinner, maybe snacks, maybe wine and cheese. They could be at a personal home. It might be in the workplace. It might be in a restaurant, wherever anyone would like to host. This is where we might have this type of event. Usually it's about 6 or 8 people at a table. And the idea is it's an unfacilitated conversation. And the conversation is about opportunities for the area where you live, some of the challenges, some of the things that you might see that you would like to happen in your community. And after those On the Table experiences, there's a survey that people fill out and send it in either by email or those that they might pick up at the event. And from that, we'll be gathering information that we will use, that Legacy Foundation will use, to determine plans for the next year through our strategic initiatives.
What got the Legacy Foundation interested in using this concept rather than, say, a larger setting? Because there have been a lot of community conversations around in the region. Lakeshore Public Media sponsored a few of them around the community, especially talking about particular issues involving race and policing and other type of very serious issues. What seems to appeal about having this type of a much more intimate setting to have a conversation?
Well, I think one of the things is that this won't be a guided conversation. So, as you mentioned, some of the other conversations have been on particular topics. These will not be on a particular topic. It'll kind of be organic, whatever it is that people want to talk about at the table. And because people are going to know one another, they may be more open in their conversations. But I think the other thing that is really critical in this process is that we want to have these conversations throughout all of Lake County. We want to know what the people in Lowell think, what the people in Gary think, what the people in Hobart, in Whiting, in Hammond, in Munster, all of the communities that are located in Lake County. And so when we gather these conversations together or gather these events together, there'll be conversations that we'll be able to say, this is what we know Lowell wants for their community. This is what Munster wants for their community. And will help us guide specific initiatives for those communities, but also for Lake County as a whole. So it's a little bit different in a couple of different ways.
Do you think that this might be perhaps the best way that the Legacy Foundation can find out the areas of need, the areas that need to be improved, rather than just a big conversation that you'll get more information out of it than just a general survey that might go out to the public, you say?
Well, I think one of the things that we want to do is engage people in the process. So just doing a survey, I don't think is really a true engagement tool, although you can gather information. Sometimes you may not get the responses, the number of responses that you would like to have. And so our hope is that by engaging these individuals and the participants in these conversations, that we'll be able to engage them in future action for their communities as well.
Okay. Now, you had a chance to bring this up here at the 24th annual meeting of the Legacy Foundation on Tuesday, May 2nd. What kind of timetable would you like to see these on-the-table conversations get started here in Lake County?
Well, the interesting thing about this process, it's a one-day event. So all of these conversations will take place on September 26th, except for maybe a few organizations. I think the Rotary Clubs may do them during that week, but they are all going to be held on September 26th. So that way we will get people together throughout the county on one day, over a meal, over coffee and donuts, or a lunch or a dinner, or in people's homes, to talk about what they'd like to see for their community. And so from that one day, then we'll be able to use the information that is provided through the surveys that they complete to help us in the future.
Now, if you plan for this event on September 26th, you get the data coming in, the comments coming in. After that, what kind of plan do you have to go with this information that you gathered forward?
Well, the University of Illinois in Chicago was hired by the Knight Foundation to put together all of the results of the survey. And they're doing that not just for Legacy Foundation, but for 9 other community foundations across the country who are participating. The other community foundations are doing theirs at different times of the year. Ours is the only one on September 26th. But the University of Illinois will be providing us with the results of all of the surveys. And we hope to have all of those results back within about 8 to 10 weeks after the event.
Sounds like that everybody, not only staff, but yourself with the Legacy Foundation, are very excited about this opportunity to be able to get University of Illinois Chicago together by way of the Knight Foundation to get this project off and running, and looking forward to whenever the data comes back in from the big gathering, so to speak, on September 26th.
Well, you know, it is exciting. And I want to use the example of Lexington, Kentucky. They just had theirs in March. They were selected by the Knight Foundation also. There were 10 of us selected for this. And Lexington, Kentucky held theirs in March. And they had a goal of reaching 5,000 people. They reached 11,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, is really it. We have a goal of 1,500 people. We would love to reach more than that. And I'm going to be announcing at this annual meeting that as of this day, we already have 100 hosts who are willing to provide some type of get-together and host those either in their homes or at their place of work or wherever it is that they might be. I think what we really are shooting for is between 200 and 250 hosts on that day, so we can get to the number that we have as our goal.
Well, you might get lucky, and maybe somebody, some organization like NIPSCO can put together like 500 or 600 people at one sitting for like lunch or something. Wouldn't that be great?
It would be. You know, and each table, even if there is a large group like that, the tables would be broken down of 6 to 8 people, so that you'll still have that intimate conversation with the other people around the table. And certainly, if you'd like to be involved with one of those, we would love to have you in one, too.
Carolyn Saxton is president and chief operating officer with the Legacy Foundation, which is Lake County's community foundation. And we're talking about a project that the Legacy Foundation is working with by way of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the University of Illinois Chicago. It's going to be a community conversation, truly a community conversation, although not everybody in one big room, but a lot of people in a lot of different rooms, a program called On the Table. It's going to get underway in September, but it's gotten kicked off at the annual meeting of the Legacy Foundation on May 2nd. Carolyn, thank you very much for the information. The best of luck on this, and we'll be looking forward to finding out more as we get closer to September 26th.
Okay, thank you. And I do want to mention that Legacy Foundation is also putting some of our own money into this project, as well as the Knight Foundation and Horizon Bank as well. So this is really a community effort, and we're excited about it.
It's beyond just hoping what the Knight brothers had thought that they wanted to do for communities that had newspapers in which they once served the communities as well, too, to be able to expand it to beyond that, too.
That's right. And we encourage anyone who would like to be involved, either by hosting or by participating, to send us an email at legacy@legacyfdn.org or give us a call at 219-736-1880.
4 years after a giant sinkhole in a sand dune swallowed a 6-year-old Illinois boy who survived the ordeal, the beach at Mount Baldy will reopen to visitors on a date to be determined, but the dune itself will not. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson talked with Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Public Information Officer Bruce Rowe.
Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore Public Information Officer Bruce Rowe says 3.5 years ago, Mount Baldy started developing holes that scientists didn't know about.
One of those holes almost cost the life of a six-year-old boy. Fortunately, he was rescued and recovered fully. But at that point, the National Park Service decided we'd better close down Mount Baldy, do some research up there to figure out what was causing these holes.
Since that time, Rose says two research projects have been conducted at Mount Baldy. The first was by Indiana University Northwest. The study indicated the holes are being formed by trees that rot away under the dune.
But there's some sort of chemical cementing action that causes the sand to almost hold the shape of the original tree and form a hole.
The Indiana Geological Survey conducted a second extensive study using ground-penetrating radar to try to determine how extensive the issue might be.
We recently received that second study, shows that we should expect many future holes to open up on Mount Baldy over the next number of years. But also what those studies showed us is that the beach itself is not a danger area for holes. There's also the high point of the dune on the western edge of it that also is free of holes.
Indiana Dune staff has been doing ranger-led hikes on the western edge of the dune for the last couple of years and will continue to do so.
But the other thing we're going to do is this summer, we're going to open up the beach in front of Mount Baldy to the general public.
Rose says that people have been looking forward to being able to access this particular area of the dunes again.
It's one of our most popular beaches. We certainly wanted to get people back out on that because so many people enjoy it, have been missing it. When we determined that there wasn't a danger of holes on it, we thought we wanted to open it. There are concerns that we have because the dune will be obviously directly behind the beach, and there will be concerns that people may decide to hike up on the dune. So what we're going to be doing is putting up some fencing, some signs explaining the danger.
And in the initial stage of the reopening, the National Park Service will heavily patrol the dune with park staff to ensure that people know that the dune is still closed except for ranger-led hikes. Rose says a new pathway also needs to be created from the existing trail to the beach. There used to be a set of wooden steps, but they were taken out by a storm about 2 years ago. Heavy equipment will be used to make a sand ramp from the path down to the beach, which is about 15 to 20 feet below. Rose says as soon as an exact date is set for the reopening, the National Park Service will announce it. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
Close out another school year in public schools here in Indiana, as well as in Northwest Indiana. We take a look at what teens are going to be doing here, and there's some concern from the Indiana Youth Institute about what a teen should be doing during the summer months and in preparing for not only maybe the next year of school for them, or maybe it's going into college, or maybe it's into whatever their work is going to be in the future. And to talk about all this, we have Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, with us. Tammy, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Of course. Always a pleasure, Chris.
Well, I know the IYI spent some time in looking into the subject of what teens should be doing and making sure that they are getting the best and the benefits. And in fact, it was the subject of a recent op-ed piece. Let's talk about that, Tammy.
Yes. One of the things that we found is this summer is going to be a great time for teens to go out and get those summer jobs, those jobs that typically fall into retail or food service or summer camps. This year, for the first year in many, many years, it's a great time for those kids to go out and get a job.
Do you think that maybe some teens, of course, a lot of teens are not really involved in looking for work during the summer months. Maybe that in some cases they're going to summer school. In some cases, they're just basically kind of chilling at home and relaxing. Do you think that maybe that if they haven't thought about looking into finding some work, it's going to be certainly a benefit even if they're in a career where they feel that they can use their brain power at the best use and maybe don't even feel like they need to get any experience during the summer months?
Well, you're absolutely right, Chris. And I'll tell you, both of my kids said, we want to chill a little this summer, and that's okay. You know, the reality is, though, if you're looking at a summer job, it doesn't necessarily have to be full-time. It doesn't have to be 5 days a week or 6 days a week or whatever that is. But we do know that there are great learnings and benefits from teens having those summer jobs, whether or not they have anything to do with their long-term career choices.
What have you folks at the IYI found about the benefits that young people can take advantage of when it's looking at work during the summer and the experiences they get that they can put to use not only if they continue on into high school to finish up their work there, but also going on to college?
Well, we know that the research tells us that teens that work learn the importance of being reliable, flexible, calm under pressure. They build those resumes. They learn how to be collaborative. You know, even if you're working in a team, four or five kids working at the local ice cream shop, that's a team. And it's important to learn how to manage multiple customers and how to manage money and how to track that. It also teaches them kids so often are the consumers of things. They're kind of the customers when they're sitting in a classroom or when they're going to a summer camp. They're the customers. This turns that the other direction and lets them know what it means to be a service provider, what it means to take care of customers, and even what it means sometimes to deal with difficult or upset customers. And all of that is valuable learning that can translate to a lot of different future experiences.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. IYI is planning a series of sessions across the Hoosier State, one of them coming up May 17th at Hobart High School here in Hobart, trying to get parents together, getting families involved for college and career planning. Tell us a little about that, Tammy.
Well, what we know is that a lot of parents are highly involved when the kids are little. You know, when they're in elementary school, they're the room mother, or they're going to PTO meetings, or they're doing whatever those things are. But that parental involvement drops dramatically as the kids age. The challenge with that is that obviously when kids are looking at college and getting ready to go to college, it can be a pretty complex process, particularly when you're talking about financial aid and what that looks like and picking the right school for your student. And so this is a way where we're really talking about how can parents engage in that college and career planning process. And so we're coming to Hobart High School. It's the last of a series throughout the state. So hopefully it'll be the best one because we'll take all the learnings that we've had in the other six cities where we've done this to really talk about what that looks like and how parents can really help coach and guide their students so that they get the best possible match for their next step.
Even coming up during the summer months here, there's also continuing efforts to get people educated about college and careers. There's a conference coming up in Indianapolis middle of June, I guess. Tell us, Tammy, about what the IYI is planning and what you're hoping to be able to take away from that.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. It's June 19th through the 21st in Indianapolis, and that's really one of the few times where a lot of folks focusing on college and career. These may be school counselors. They're also university admissions professionals come together, as well as some of those after-school professionals that work with kids on their next steps come together, and we talk about what are some of the new best practices, what's going on, really career readiness, and what options are out there that maybe you haven't thought of or that you've thought of, but you're not really sure how to help teens access that. So again, we want all of our kids to reach their full potentials and be really productive and happy citizens. That benefits all of our communities and all of us.
I guess there are quite a few topics that are going to come up during this conference. I know some of them are very practical ones on how parents can learn how to be able to pay for their youngsters' higher education. But there are also some other issues, too, that are rather serious. Tell us, one of them in particular, I guess, is about preventing suicide. Tell us about that topic.
It is. Unfortunately, Indiana ranks third highest in the nation on the number of our teens that contemplate or attempt suicide. So this is a really big deal, and it's important that we understand what those red flags look like and that we, as those folks working with teens, we understand how to recognize those red flags and how to respond appropriately. Actually, the governor just signed a new bill which will require educators, teachers, to have ongoing education as far as suicide prevention. It is, like I said, unfortunately, a really tragic number for our state, and we're all actively working to reduce that. We want our kids to understand there are great futures out there for them, and we want to connect them to those.
And also, too, I understand one of the topics they're going to talk about as well is how to retain young men of color in higher education.
Absolutely. And again, we're having an expert speaker come in. He actually calls himself the Chief Energy Officer, Dr. Adolph Brown, and he's talking about what it means for kids of color, particularly boys of color. Sometimes when they transition to higher ed, it's a new experience or they don't feel as connected as some other kids. And what can we do to prevent that? We want to keep them in school. Again, make sure that we're harnessing all of that great potential. Make sure that we're making it a success center and success stories all over the state for all of our kids.
This 2017 College and Career Conference is coming up again June 19th through the 21st. It's going to be held in Indianapolis. And Tammy, if anybody's interested to find out more, would like to be able to get signed up, register for the event, how can they do so?
They can do so at IYI.org. So whether you want to go to the May 17th event at Hobart High School or the other event in June, the big conference in Indianapolis, you sign up at the same place, IYI.org, and you can just click right on our website and get signed up.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Thanks for the info, Tammy, and I hope that the conference in the summer months come up very successful, and a lot of people, especially from Northwest Indiana, make the trek to Indianapolis to attend the sessions there. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Thanks so much.
New legislation passed this General Assembly session aims to help more young people who have aged out of the foster system connect with Medicaid coverage through the age of 26. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that a majority don't have health insurance.
Nineteen-year-old Catherine Peraza lives on the south side of Indianapolis. She's drying off her three-month-old baby, Junior. He just had a bath.
But we also like for him to, like, touch things and, you know, feel different objects. Just a good monster puppy.
Peraza is one of the 71% of female former foster care youth who have children before the age of 21. She was born in El Salvador but has residency status. She's been a ward of the state since she was 7.
When I became a resident here, I had full coverage. And so, you know, I could go to the dentist and everything, vision. But then all of a sudden when I got pregnant, I found out that I didn't have that coverage anymore.
An estimated 500 youth age out of Indiana's foster care system every year, and many don't know they need to re-enroll for Medicaid, so they're bumped off. And like Peraza, many learn this when they become pregnant. A social worker helped her find a doctor and set up a $5 copay during her prenatal care.
And so that was really good, since I can't afford all that stuff.
Despite having an emergency C-section, mother and baby are healthy. But Peraza says she's still confused about coverage.
And I don't even understand my own insurance. Like, what's going on?
Hoosiers who age out of foster care in Indiana have been having problems connecting with health insurance for years, despite a provision under the Affordable Care Act that establishes coverage for former foster youth between the ages of 18 to 26.
From our research, we found nearly 6 in 10 former foster youth in Indiana didn't receive Medicaid at any point after age 18.
Brent Kent is the CEO of Indiana Connected by 25, a nonprofit that helps young people transition out of foster care and into the community. There are more than 22,000 former foster youth in Indiana. He says many suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and chronic stress can lead to chronic illness.
So they're racking up needless medical debt. It's affecting their ability to keep a job, find stable housing, finish college. And for this population, it's particularly important.
A new law passed this year by Indiana lawmakers aims to close that health care gap. The new law requires the Department of Child Services and the Medicaid office to make sure youth aging out of the system are enrolled until 26, so they won't be bumped off for not re-enrolling. Todd Lloyd is a senior associate with the Jim Casey Youth Opportunities Initiative. He's working on this issue on a national level. He says Indiana is actually ahead of the curve.
There are very few states that have made such significant strides.
Lloyd says continued coverage for young adults is one of the most popular parts of health reform.
Widespread appeal, right, among families that their children are able to be covered under their parents' coverage until age 26. But perhaps the greatest challenge these young people are facing as they leave foster care is that they don't have family to rely on.
Former foster care youth Catherine Peraza is taking courses at IUPUI, and she has aspirations to become involved in the healthcare field. She had a chance meeting with a nurse at the restaurant where she works recently.
We had just, I don't know, we got into a conversation, and she told me she was a nurse. I was like, really? I'm wanting to go to school to be a nurse. She's like, really? I was like, yes.
She hopes this new law will help her better connect with services so she can focus on her future with one less worry.
You know, like, I'm positive. I'm okay right now. Like, I'm calm because when I talked to the lady, she had said she didn't doubt that he would get insurance and that I had insurance too. But I'd love to understand it.
The law goes into effect July 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting and Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Some Indiana University employees say they were pleasantly surprised recently to learn that the university is pushing up the effective date for an expanded paid parental leave policy. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us about it.
IU already offered up to 6 weeks of paid parental leave to faculty, but announced last month it would extend the benefit to qualifying staff members who give birth or adopt a child on or after July 1st. But the university recently announced it's moving that date up to apply to births or adoptions on or after April 14th. That's good news for IU sociology professor Jessica Calarco, who's due with her second child on June 17th. Her husband's a staff member at IU and will now be able to take paid parental leave instead of using vacation time.
I'm a sociologist, and I study kids and families, and the research tells us that dad's involvement, especially early on in kids' lives, has huge benefits both for the child and then also for the family as a whole in terms of dads being more egalitarian in terms of their child care roles and in terms of their participation in housework.
Calarco says her family's still trying to figure out if the new policy will change their post-birth plans. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
An Illinois congresswoman and a team of elected officials joined gun violence prevention advocates on Capitol Hill late last week to fight against a corporate gun lobby agenda. Medill News Services' Alexis Wainwright attended the rally, and she has this for Lakeshore's Public Radio.
Robin Kelly from Illinois. Good afternoon. I am so honored to be here with you, and I'm honored to be a part of this team.
Illinois Representative Robin Kelly and a team of elected officials joined gun violence prevention advocates on Capitol Hill to fight against corporate gun lobby agenda.
But I'm also sad that I have to be a part of this team and sad that I have to be with you today because we have not progressed.
Former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords led a press conference to demand political leaders take action against the corporate gun lobby agenda.
Now is the time to come together. Be responsible. Democrats, Republicans, everyone. We must never stop fighting. Fight, fight, fight.
Giffords survived a 2011 mass shooting where six others died.
The courage to do what's right. The courage and new ideas.
Every day, 91 Americans are killed by a gun. Representative Kelly says this is unacceptable.
I'm not going to give up. I'm in this to win this.
For the first time in 30 years, a sitting president has addressed the National Rifle Association. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Alexis Wainwright.
On Friday, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb, U.S. Senators Joe Donnelly and Todd Young, U.S. Representative Pete Visglosky, and East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland issued a joint statement pledging the improved coordination, communication, and the cleanup of the USS-led Superfund site in East Chicago. And here's the statement. The recent meeting in East Chicago back in April signals our renewed commitment to restore public trust by improving communication and coordination and delivering real solutions for protecting health and public safety in the community, especially for the families impacted by the closure of the West Calumet housing complex. The painful personal stories of the East Chicago residents will guide us as we chart a new path forward, and we are extremely grateful to each person who bravely shared their comments. EPA and IDEM will continue the efforts to remediate the Superfund site and work to ensure safe drinking water is provided through the city's public water system. In addition, officials remain committed to investigating the sources, size, and scope of the lead contamination, as well as informing the public and quickly implementing remedies, if necessary, to ensure that the residents of East Chicago have access to safe drinking water. The joint statement finishes up by saying these actions are in addition to the recently signed state legislation directing testing of the city's water, coupled with a law that requires a plan be filed with the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission detailing how lead service line replacement will be completed in conjunction with the ongoing infrastructure replacement. And they concluded the statement by saying we will continue moving forward together until the job is done. Residents deserve nothing less. That's the joint statement made on Friday by U.S. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, Governor Eric Holcomb, Senators Joe Donnelly and Todd Young, Congressman Pete Visglosky, and East Chicago Mayor Anthony Copeland. Despite the progress at the state and the federal levels, many East Chicago residents are frustrated with the public officials who are in charge of cleaning up that lead-contaminated neighborhood in the city. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports on the residents' continued struggles, the help they've received so far, and what's left to be done.
Hi, Keisha. How you doing?
Keisha Daniels just moved from one lead-contaminated neighborhood to another.
This is nice. How do you like it?
Let me show you around.
This is my kitchen. I'm getting it together. It's not all I want because we have to fix some things, the landlord. But so far, so good. Lead-free, I guess.
Got the water filter.
Yeah. Now, this is the
Both her new house and her old West Calumet housing complex apartment are in the East Chicago lead-contaminated Superfund site. The city is tearing down her old home because of extremely high levels of lead in the soil, so she had to move. The Environmental Protection Agency told Daniels and her sons this new front yard is lead-free. They offered to move the family off the Superfund site to Chicago, but Daniels didn't like that option.
I'm still worried about everything. We're still doing the bottled water a lot. I just feel safer in East Chicago. I was born and raised here, so I've been here 40-plus years, so I'm kind of nervous about going somewhere else.
Like Daniels, most West Calumet residents have moved now. That's Zone 1 of the Superfund. It tested for the highest lead levels. But she also says residents in the other two zones have a lot left to fight for, even though they aren't being relocated.
So now the struggle still continues because I still have family in 2 and I live in 3. So it's not going to stop just because I moved out of Zone 1.
Daniels really hasn't stopped. In the past month, she's had her bones tested for lead. She doesn't know her results yet. She traveled to Washington, D.C. to advocate for lead-free housing, and she met with state leaders and EPA Chief Scott Pruitt.
Water is a human right.
On that day, when Pruitt was in town, I met Tyra Taylor, standing on her porch watching a group of activists march for clean air and water in East Chicago and protest Pruitt's appointment to lead the EPA.
So today's my turn to get dug up. You see, they even brought a whole machine in here. I didn't even notice that till now.
Bushes and mounds of dirt surround the excavator, which digs out the contaminated soil and replaces it with clean soil. A letter sent to her by the EPA explains.
It says the soils will be removed from your property because sampling results showed your lead contaminations are above 400 mg or arsenic concentrations above 26 mg.
Taylor says she's grateful, but she's far from satisfied. She says more crews are needed to do the work faster. While residents who met with Pruitt that day say officials didn't relay specific plans for the future, it does sound like Taylor's wish might come true. Here's Regional EPA Administrator Robert Kaplan speaking with reporters after Pruitt's press conference.
So the most important aspect is getting out into the field earlier, that's what we did, and committing to more residents being done, and that's what we did as well.
Officials are making more progress. Most recently, the city reached an agreement with the state to begin replacing lead drinking water pipes. On the other hand, an investigation by the Northwest Indiana Times found evidence that there's lead paint dust surrounding homes reserved for people moving out of lead-contaminated Zone 1. And residents like Tyra Taylor say they continue to be frustrated because they have to deal with lead contamination every hour of every day, and they've been doing it for decades.
You know, they're having meetings and people coming in from out of state, senator, or, you know, whatever. That's fine, but you come for that day, you hear our complaints, you hear our problems, and you may be concerned, heartfelt, but then you go on. You have to go back to the rest of what's on your desk, per se. You know, we are just in a pile. You know, we are a pile of paperwork.
Taylor and Daniel say the Calumet neighborhood used to be a tight-knit community, but they feel isolated now, like their lives have been turned upside down, and $1,000 and a Section 8 voucher aren't enough to replace family. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
An Indianapolis attorney isn't giving up after the state's highest court shut down his quest to gain access to emails from former Governor Mike Pence. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Becca Costello tells us, William Groth says he's now focusing on other document requests.
William Groth has been trying to get a court to order former governor and now Vice President Mike Pence to release certain documents outlining a legal strategy for challenging then-President Barack Obama's executive order on immigration. The Indiana Supreme Court last week declined to send the lawsuit back to trial, which Groth says lets the lower court's decision in Pence's favor stand.
The Court of Appeals decision
does further water down the public's right to know and further weakens our transparency laws.
Gross says now that the lawsuit is dead, he's filing a public records request for documents related to the carrier deal President-elect Donald Trump brokered last fall. That deal gave the manufacturing company state tax incentives in exchange for keeping some jobs in Indianapolis instead of outsourcing them to Mexico as planned.
Depending on how much of the information we get and the reasonableness of the governor's withholding or reasons for withholding certain documents, we may or may not make a decision to file another lawsuit.
Gross says he's still committed to increasing government transparency. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Becca Costello.
Coming up tomorrow, Tuesday, Hoosiers are going to have a chance to participate in a rather unique conversational model at restaurants all across the Hoosier State. It's being sponsored by Indiana Humanities, and one of these opportunities will come up in Valparaiso, and they will be facilitated by a number of people across the state at each of these conversations. And we're talking with David Hoppe, who is a writer. Besides writing books, he also writes a column for Nuvo, which is Indianapolis's alternative weekly newspaper, and other things as well, too. And the topic is going to be a very interesting one here. And David Hoppe, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
The Indiana Humanities calls these conversations Chew on This. Are you sure? They've come up with an interesting way to title it. What is this topic going to be all about, basically, that folks will have a chance to talk about, especially if they show up for the special event, as is going to happen on Tuesday at the Dish Restaurant in Valparaiso?
Well, it does sound rather like you've gotten a mouthful of something that you're not so sure about.
For some people, it might be true, yes.
Yeah. Well, Chew on This is a series of dinner parties, actually, that take place all around the state, and there are opportunities for people to gather around a meal and have a dinner table conversation about an interesting subject. In this case, Are You Sure? Has to do with the situation that I think more and more of us find ourselves in today, which has to do with whether we're really sure about whatever information happens to be crossing our thresholds, personal thresholds at the time. You know, what constitutes truth? What constitutes validity? What do we believe in terms of what we hear or read or see via various media? I think there's been a lot of discussion about how polarized America seems to become these days, and this has a lot to do with the fact that more and more people are getting more and more of their information from a greater variety of sources. And rather than bringing us together, all of these sources seem to be atomizing us in various ways as we, you know, sort of divide ourselves into various tribes and camps based on the extent to which whatever we're seeing reinforces the beliefs we already have. So here we're hearing about fake news, we're hearing about truthiness, we're hearing about these various shades in between having to do with what constitutes what's real or what's actually happening out there. And our dinner conversation at Dish on Tuesday night is not going to be about trying to determine what's real or what's true, but it's going to be about trying to air out a little bit how it is that we begin to try and figure these things out for ourselves.
As a facilitator of this conversation coming up, you think it's an opportunity, I guess, for people to talk amongst themselves as well as with you about finding ways to be able to take a look at this info, since we're getting so much information from so many different sources these days, to be able to figure out how to best use that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And I think it's really for us to have a chance to share with one another a little bit about how it is that we come to our own personal reckonings with regard to what we believe or what we don't. It's not so much what it is we believe as how we come to these conclusions. How are we gathering the information that we feel we need or that helps us to reach the conclusions that we do, whether that has to do with casting a vote or buying a product, or, you know, choosing a particular course in life.
Now, how did Indiana Humanities get involved in taking on such a project like this?
Well, my understanding is that, you know, they're attempting to build a bridge here between the humanities and the sciences. You know, science has really been at the heart of a lot of these discussions, it seems. You know, we see this played out, for example, with regard to climate change. There is still a great deal of controversy surrounding climate change, though, you know, the scientists in this field would say that there is almost unanimity with regard to, you know, what is causing climate change and what its severity might be. Nevertheless, that hasn't been enough to necessarily sway some people in their beliefs with this in this regard. And so, you know, that's on the science side of it. Science, which, you know, traditionally is thought to be, you know, all about facts and evidence and so on. That's supposed to be the hard end of this discussion. Mm-hmm. But even that is open to, you know, conjecture and debate. And increasingly so, it seems. And so that kind of makes the sciences look a little bit more like the humanities, if you will. The humanities are also about inquiry and about how we, you know, try to learn things, how we try to find things out. And so we seem to be at a moment where the humanities and the sciences may have more in common than perhaps they have seemed to for some time. And I think hence this conversation. I think that this is a conversation that gives us a chance to explore this kind of interesting overlap that we're experiencing right now between the humanities and the sciences.
And we've been carrying some of the humanities programs called Quantum Leap Soundbites here as this thematic initiative continues for the Indiana Humanities. And they have some interesting topics that they've brought up every single week since they've offered the soundbites here. Do you think that this Quantum Leap initiative fits in well with this idea of having an opportunity to get together over a meal and talk about these issues?
I hope so. I think that, generally speaking, what Indiana Humanities tries to do, and I think has done a really great job of doing, has been to raise different types of issues for people to think about and to talk about. That's really what this is all about. And I hasten to say, this is not about reaching a particular conclusion or finding some kind of closure on these issues, because that's really just about impossible. What is possible, though, is the opportunity for people to come together in a civil way to be able to talk about these things, share their ideas, and get conversation started. I think that's really important, and I think that also helps to build community.
Now, there may be some space still available if you'd like to take part in this latest initiative, the Chew on This, Are You Sure? Conversation that's going to happen tomorrow evening at the Dish Restaurant in Valparaiso. That's up on Calumet Avenue on the north side of Valparaiso. If you go on the Eventbrite website and type in Chew on This, Are You Sure? You'll get some more information about it, and you can go ahead and put your bid in and see if you can pick up an opportunity to enjoy a reservation for a nice meal as well as a great conversation as well, too. David Hoppe is going to be the facilitator at the Valparaiso event happening on Tuesday evening at the Dish Restaurant in Valparaiso. David, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your comments. I hope that it turns out to be not only a good meal for you and everybody else that attends as well, but an opportunity to get some interesting conversation started and pick up some information along the way, too. Thanks for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris.
And on this Monday, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Phil Potempa, Director of Marketing at Theater at the Center. And Phil, welcome back.
Thank you.
And one of my favorite musicals of all time is Cabaret.
All right, you're in the right place then.
I've been in it. I've seen it. I've seen the original. I've seen the movie. And I've seen the more recent one with Alan Cumming at Studio 54 in New York. So what version are we going to see this time?
And that's a great question. And audiences probably scratch their head and think, what version? There's only one version. It's Cabaret. And that's not the case, as you just pointed out. There's the film version. The version that Linda Fortunato, our director and choreographer, has chosen is the 1998 version, which is, again, a little more recent. But she has decided that she wants to be a little bit more kind of have some fun with it, with what she says it's not going to be so much bawdy or racy. She says it'll be a little suggestive. So a bit of a tease to the audiences. Mm-hmm. Of some of the debauchery that would happen behind these closed doors of the cabaret, but as she puts it, not in your face, you know. So that, I guess, is up to the imagination of the audience.
Yeah, at Studio 54, it was pretty much in your face.
Yes, and that's the version I think I saw when the Broadway tour came through not too long ago, down on Chicago, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And they had little cabaret tables you could set at down front.
Fun.
And Alan Cumming was right there. It was great. It was really cool. But so the show itself is based on the writings of Christopher Isherwood, who lived in Berlin during the Weimar. Well, I guess it would be the early Nazi years, actually.
Correct.
Yeah, after the Weimar Republic fell. So and it was a time of terrible inflation that they'd gone through after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And people were ruined, and there was so this whole Bohemian element rose up.
That's right. A chance to escape.
Yeah.
That's
a place
right.
To escape. So tell us about it.
Okay. So what we've gotten is, again, a chance for you to come into an atmosphere that is a bit of, you want to feel as though you're kind of behind these closed doors and you can kind of do whatever you want, that carefree spirit that was happening just as the unrest was happening, as you talked about, with the political change with the Nazi Party coming into power. So in Berlin, this was a chance where people could come in and forget your troubles, forget your cares, just like the lyrics say. And so many people think of Sally Bowles, the character that was played by Liza Minnelli in the movie in 1972, but really, it's told through the eyes of the American writer. So I myself as a writer can see this part being something that is the narrative for it. And so Patrick Tierney, who is a favorite of our stage, he'll be playing that role of Cliff. And then he meets, of course, these characters within the cabaret. Sally Bowles is the singer that lures him. And then the mischievous, whimsical MC, who you said Alan Cumming did such a fantastic job portraying, which I did not see that tour when it came through Chicago since he's New York-based, but it's still a chance to have some fun and feel a little bit naughty.
Mm-hmm. And this production has the story of Fräulein Schneider and Herr Schultz.
It does. And you were talking about exactly, this was a time when people had to ration what they had. And so there's that wonderful song where the gentleman that runs the fruit market presents the landlady that is his next door neighbor with a pineapple, which was certainly this coveted find back then because you didn't have access to such things as fruits, which would be considered a luxury at that time.
Yeah. The movie doesn't emphasize that story much at all. I think Fräulein Schneider is their landlady, I believe.
Correct.
But I don't know that Herr Schultz is in it at all.
I don't believe so.
But that's a big part of this production.
It is. And we have the wonderful Iris Lieberman returning, and she played the heavy, the meanie in Annie Warbucks, our holiday show, and she's a favorite. She's been on our stage with Fiddler, which, speaking of being on our stage, Cabaret has never been done on our stage, which I can't believe with this 26, 27-year history of programming, Cabaret's not been done for our audience. So this is certainly fresh for our audience is Northwest Indiana.
Well, a bunch of us amateurs did it in 1990 on the stage.
On our stage at the Performing Arts Center, okay.
And I was the MC, and a woman named Kathy Siegert from Crown Point was Sally Bowles, and we had done this as a community theater production in Crown Point, and some people who were involved with us with the Arts Center back then saw it and wanted us to do it at the Arts Center. So, because there were two community, well, there had been an earlier community theater production when the building first opened, maybe in 89, I guess it would have been in 89,
yes.
Yeah. And that was Sweeney Todd.
Okay.
Yeah. And a lot of people who were involved in community theater throughout Northwest Indiana were in that production.
So would it be on our Wall of Fame, as audiences and patrons know that outside in the lobby we have all the productions framed, or would it be just proceed maybe when some of that staged programming was happening? Do you think there's a photo up on our wall?
No. Because it wasn't a theater at the center production.
Actually,
there was no
using
theater
the house.
At the center
okay.
quite yet.
Okay.
That came along shortly. thereafter. Yeah. So the show runs through.
Yes, it's May the 4th through June the 4th. And again, you want to get tickets because it's an intimate 400-seat space. You're right there in the cabaret, so you can't do better than that.
Okay. Well, great, Phil. Thanks for being here to tell us about cabaret. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And that's John Kay with Eye on the Arts, talking with Phil Potempa, the Marketing Director for Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Munster. Tune in again next Monday at this time for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.